So things like foreign material detection, detecting things like material other than grain in a feed mix, mog, foreign materials, stones, etc. Adulteration, things like melamine and other adulterants that can be detected using NIR technology.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Kemin invites you to optimize animal feed quality and safety with our portfolio of solutions. Learn more at kemin.com/AG. Evonik, we are sciencing the global food challenge.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Feed Science Podcast brought to you by Wisenetics. My name is Bob Odker, and we're going to talk a little bit today about sampling and testing and see if we can learn something. So I'm going to ask Gretchen to introduce herself and tell you what's going on.
Hello, my name is Gretchen Mosier. I am a professor in agricultural and biosystems engineering at Iowa State University in Ames, Iowa. And my job, my research appointment, involves testing and controls of feed and feed ingredients, grain, bulk grain, as it comes off the field, so post-harvest. And I don't know if inheriting is the right word, but I am inheriting a testing program in near-infrared spectroscopy this fall from my longtime colleague, Charles Herberg, who has led that program for nearly the last half century. So my background is quality management systems and statistical process controls. And so this is a good fit for my background, but it is a new application for me. And so I'm anxious to talk a little bit about it and talk to people about, you know, why should they pay for this testing and what information does it give you? So glad to be here.
Oh, that sounds great. We're glad to have you. And we're always open to learning new things. I like to learn something new every day. So with that in mind, you know, why don't you give us some information or some idea on what kind of information we might get from testing?
So when you think about testing feed or feed ingredients, we think about it from two aspects. There's, of course, the wet chemistry method of testing. It is slow and relatively expensive, but it is really the gold standard of the test. What I'm going to talk about more today is near-infrared spectroscopy, which is a rapid, non-destructive analytical method of testing. And it is especially helpful testing ingredients, and single ingredients is where it's the strongest because it is very dependent on a calibration spectral curve that takes a little bit of time and energy to put together. It is heavily embedded with statistical ideas and concepts, which I am not going to get into today. And I don't think the average user needs to understand all of the statistics behind a near-infrared spectroscopy test to be able to utilize it effectively. So I think that's going to be a key message for me, too, is that you don't need to know all the background to understand the results and to use them effectively to improve your process.
Okay. Makes sense. Kind of like you don't need to know how to build an airplane to ride on one, right? You
can just... They're a good analogy. Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, what kind of information are you looking for? You know, can you give us some specifics on what you would test for on specific ingredients or grains?
Probably the biggest things that we're looking for when we test feed ingredients, such as corn, soybeans, wheat, or soybean meal and wheat. We are looking for things like moisture. So that will definitely be important for post-harvest storage and drying if necessary. But more importantly are the nutrient ingredients that make up a feed ration. So protein, oil, starch, fiber, those types of things, and specifically the total digestible nutrient load, things that relate to energy values and calculation, all can come from that test. So you calculate the protein, the oil, the starch, the density, and the moisture. It makes it a lot easier to calculate the energy value. You have all the values there, and those values have been validated and are pretty straightforward, even if you're not a mathematician. So it is a pretty straightforward calculation.
Okay, so this is kind of a move away from the old of just having a standard value for, let's say, DDGs. Instead of that, we may now have a vendor specific value for DDGs by testing their product.
Potentially, you could. You always have the option to use the book value that comes from AFCO or wherever, American Association of Feed Control Officials, put a good publication out every year, and it doesn't change a lot from year to year, but the variability in climate and growing conditions and, you know, water levels, moisture levels, rainfall, precipitation, weather conditions, and so on, can influence the crop coming out of the field and therefore influence the reference chemistry that could eventually impact the calculation of the calibration model. So it's a long kind of winding road, but the bottom line is it could affect the readings that you're getting on your feed ingredients. So it's good to probably get at least something that has been updated in the last year with this year's crop will give you the best in terms of accuracy and precision, the best value, the best reading, if you will.
So give us some examples of how you would use that information in your thought process, perhaps your formulation process or your overall business decision making.
That's a great question. And that's probably one of the things I'm most excited to talk about. Of course, ingredient formulation and feed formulation, the amount of protein, the amount of oil, the amount for end use, the amount of specialized high value ingredients can be easily identified and segregated using near-infrared spectroscopy and testing. That's the first thing. And we have quite a bit of research that has been completed that demonstrates that these are feasible things that we can calculate and can segregate based on. But there are several other things. So things like foreign material detection, detecting things like material other than grain in a feed mix, MOG, foreign materials, stones, etc., adulteration, things like melamine and other adulterants that can be detected using NIR technology. Of course, biological contamination, things like aflatoxin and fumonisin, DON. In Iowa last year, we take a county-by-county sample every year. We did not have a lot in 2024 of aflatoxin, but we had low levels of fumonisin in nearly every county we sampled in, which is all 99 of our counties. Those levels were not high enough to meet the tolerance level, but they were there. They were able to be detected. It was a little bit of an odd conclusion. Usually we say, nope, it's not here, or yes, it is. And we didn't really have the ability to say that. So things like that, biological contamination. And there has actually been some research that has examined whether we could identify the infection to the kernel level, to the unit level. That is still ongoing, I think. I don't know if I would say confidently that is something we could feasibly do. Chemical composition, as I mentioned, moisture, protein, oil, especially helpful when you're trying to determine end use and segregate potentially so that you can get the highest value from the crop. And then finally, hardness and mixing uniformity. And this is more specific to feed than it is to bulk grain, but kernel hardness, bulk density, breakage susceptibility, things like that, all have the opportunity and the ability and have been tested and examined to determine the feasibility. All have been determined to be feasible. Some are easier than others. Common uses are, of course, biological and chemical composition and contamination. But a lot of uses for these, as well as risk management, right? It was really the testing that found in a couple, I think it was 5-6 years ago, when they found melamine in feed. Melamine looks like protein, right? And it was that type of testing procedure that located some of those contaminants and was able to get them stopped before they were widely distributed, as I understand. So it's worth it on the risk, on the risk management perspective. The question is how much, right? And how much is it going to cost? How much sampling is needed and how much will it cost? In 1994, my colleague Herberg et al. Found 2 to 3 cents a bushel when it's related to soybeans. That's not a small amount of money, right, on soybeans, considering when you scale that up. Updated work related to this, and we looked at segregating, isolating non-GM as a higher value crop in feed for both corn ingredients and soybean ingredients, and found 3 to 4 cents a bushel costs for soybeans, 7 to 8 cents a bushel cost for corn. And of course, the larger the number of bushels that are processed, the lower the costs, as you would expect in economies of scale. Still not an insignificant amount of money. 7 cents, 8 cents a bushel is a lot of money when you're talking about 5 million bushels, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
And so it makes sense to think about this very judiciously, I think, when you're thinking about how much testing, how much segregating are we thinking of doing? And I think it, from my perspective, it helps to have a plan what you're going to do with those products when they come in. And to really have a good idea of their characteristics broadly as they are, as you're receiving them in the fall. I think not taking it in blind really increases the risk that there's going to be something there. And then if the feds come back and say, do you have anything? How do you know? Right? You could say, in fact, we have taken a sample a day, a sample a week, or whatever, and you can say, here's our record, and that shows no problem. Even if there is a problem somewhere that you didn't catch, you could at least say, look, we have the due diligence, right? We've had the record keeping. Yes, there may be a problem, and if you can find it, you know, you track it down, but ultimately, your data did not suggest, or if it did, then you could track down the problem and get it resolved before it becomes a big problem, which happens very quickly when you begin to blend grain and feed loads and move them down the river or on the rail car. Bigger and bigger containers make for things that are harder and harder to find. So
yeah, and I think too, I'd interject as a feed guy all my life. I mean, we handle grain, but I'm a feed guy. And, you know, you sometimes might assume that somebody else has taken care of this for you on the front end. And then you learn later on in life that that's not necessarily the case, and that it would be a good idea to take a look for yourself as you are, as you say, as the feed manufacturer. We're going to be responsible, liable potentially. Yeah, having some sort of testing program. As you talk about this infrared testing, is it also possible? I know this machine does a big spectrum of things, but you know, let's say I want to specifically look for just a few things. Can they be calibrated to you know, cover what I'm interested in? Selfishly, I'll ask.
Yes, most of the time, I think that's something that those that work in near infrared spectroscopy. In more depth rather than just as a method, right? So I'm kind of a methodology person. I use it as a method to the means to the end, if you will. But there are those who really are on the more of the innovation, developing the instruments, things like that. One of the things they really enjoy and find helpful and interesting is the development of new calibration models to cover these specific ingredients or specific traits within ingredients. But does it have the capability? Absolutely, across a variety of different exams, either or tests. We look at things that are commonly done, but definitely you can test a variety of ingredients.
Now, things that pop to mind, you know, for me might be more simple things like protein, for example, perhaps amino acid profiles, the things where if I'm really trying to limit the amount of synthetic amino acid I use, knowing what I've got in the ration already is a great start, right? So I'm not putting a half a pound too much of something in every ton of feed I make, that type of thing.
It does. I think it is a good way to manage costs, particularly when you're talking about something expensive like protein. Protein is the most expensive of all the feed ingredients, and it's the most important for a lot of from a lot of perspectives. And I think having a better handle on, you know, how much synthetic should we add and how much, there's a fair amount of variability in protein, in protein intensive ingredients as they come in. Corn, soybeans vary enough that I think, I'm not an animal nutritionist as you are, but I understand that some animals are more sensitive than others to these variabilities in the protein levels.
And to be clear, I'm not actually a trained nutritionist. I'm an operations guy. I just like to think I'm a nutritionist. So when it
you
when
work
it fits.
More in nutrition on the animal side than I do.
Well, they forced me into understanding some of it, yes, ma'am. So, but I do find it interesting. And the other thing I'm thinking of here is the quick results that I played with this a little bit years ago when the high oil corn came in. You know, and we had to test for high oil corn, and so I'm not ignorant of how this works, but we knew, you know, we knew by the time the corn got to the pit what bin that corn needed to go into. So I'm thinking about, you know, if I'm sitting in a feed mill that uses 5 or 6 loads of DDGs a day, if I'm taking samples and doing subsamples and sending them in for wet lab, I mean, that DDG is already in a pit basically before I know the value of it. And I'd know right away if I had one of these machines, right?
Yes, yes. And it's right, if you had one of the machines, and we did a study, my colleagues and I, a graduate student, Herberg and I, collaborated on a study where they did just that. And they were looking, do protein levels vary by region in Iowa? And could we predict them based on these regional locations on where they were grown and harvested? And we did find that there was some variability. In that study, we also added some simulated systematic and random error. And I would be remiss if I didn't talk about that. There's a lot of measurement error embedded in the process of measuring, whether it's NIR or other types of measurement tools and methodologies. So we found that systematic and random errors could influence those outputs. But that's why I think one of my primary points should be, you should be thinking about this before there's a problem, right? Just like everything else in life, right? When you think about what should I be testing and why, and can justify it. And I think from the Food Safety Modernization Act perspective, they appreciate that level of thought process as well, to say, we know where these hazards exist, and we are putting methodologies in place to both identify them as well as to mitigate them, and then eventually remove them if necessary. And testing is one way you do that.
And I think you bring up an important point there. Any potential hazard that we can mitigate, in other words, eliminate, is a lot easier than trying to figure out SOP or something to handle that hazard. So there's definitely value in these things that, you know, it's probably not going to show up as a check in the mail, but it's in the long run, it's going to provide you a lot of security knowledge. You know, I'm even thinking about looking at, you know, we've got our tags, right? We have our guaranteed analysis of everything we buy. For 20 years or 25 years of my career, you really never challenged that. You told the people what you wanted, and when they sent it, you assumed it was right. And that may not always be the case. So you can add in there, just kind of keeping an eye on your suppliers.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Just validation of what you are having tested offsite or wherever else that this comes up, right? As you could say, well, that's not what our data says, right?
Yeah, you can contest, you know, big differences, and certainly at least might be an indicator you need to send in some extra wet labs or something to confirm. It's just knowledge that you have that can help us out, I think.
Yes, indeed. And I think from my perspective, so at Iowa State, we have a testing lab where we do a lot of these types of things. we couldn't turn tests around. We could turn them around pretty quickly, a week or less usually, but not enough to make a decision at the scale, that's for sure. As they're sitting on the scale waiting to dump, right? That's probably too fast. But having a near-infrared instrument at the elevator would facilitate that type of decision-making. When we bring products in that we're testing, we run them through the moisture meters first thing to determine where we're going to store them, in the lab at room temperature or in the cooler at 40 degrees Fahrenheit, right? Because some of them come in high enough in moisture. Anything above 12%, we'd like to have cooled, so that 12% moisture content. Just so we keep samples sometimes for a long time, but that's not a trait unique to the testing lab, right? Samples can come in and sit in a bin or a storage facility for a long time before they are moved. And it's good to know what the trait characteristics are at receipt for storage purposes. And if you're thinking, what should I get rid of? What should I put on this train, right? So I don't have to deal with the quality anymore. That's another reason to have that knowledge and you're kind of in your back pocket and just use that. They're not in your back pocket, but certainly in your spreadsheet, right?
And again, when I think about feed, if I'm going to send feed to a large facility that's going to sit in a bin 3 or 4 days potentially before they start feeding it, I mean, molds start growing in just a few hours, right?
Right.
Potentially.
They can
happen.
Yeah.
Now we start talking about perhaps breeding stock, dairy animals, that kind of stuff. I mean, that all can get pretty important pretty quick.
It can, yes. And dairy are particularly sensitive to variabilities, as we should say, probably in feed, as I understand. So for a lot of reasons.
Yeah. And typically, if something happens at any kind of farm, the first thing we think about is something's wrong with the feed, right? So once again, having that that record keeping, that process to look back and say, no, everything looks as it should, doesn't guarantee that's not the reason, but at least you can say, hey, our records indicate there was nothing abnormal here.
Exactly. Well, and it doesn't happen very often, but when there is a recall of feed ingredients or feed itself, probably the best position for you to be in as a handler or a holder of these ingredients is to say, we can say with 100% certainty that our product is not in this load that is being recalled, right? I mean, it's a lovely position to be in. It is unusual to have that level of certainty, but with good record keeping, it's definitely feasible to be able to say that, right? If you know where things are gone, where they're at, what their traits are, and they say, well, we've got this massive recall and we're not sure. This is just common when they recall feed ingredients or feed animal feed. They often don't know where the origin of the contaminant is.
Right.
So feed, yeah. We know it's not with us. That's a
and
great
that can be very important.
It would save a lot of time and expense that would be potentially utilized in backtracking, trying to figure out where did we send that stuff anyway, right? So it doesn't happen very often, but when it does, it's a high, as we would say, a high severity event, right? Pretty disruptive.
Absolutely. And it's been my experience that when you have those situations and you do start doing your investigation, the investigation stops when you get to the guy that doesn't have any documentation. I mean, the guy who says, well, I'm sure it's okay. You don't get past that step. So I think it's important to have our ducks in a row and be ready for a recall if one occurs.
Exactly. And if you do fall under the jurisdiction of the Food Safety Modernization Act, they require generally that you have a recall plan, particularly if you have hazards that you've identified. So that is a requirement. But I think it's a good practice to have it even when you don't have hazards that you have identified as requiring a preventive control.
I agree completely. And I would just add to that too, though, is I spend a good deal of my time trying to be compliant. When we can find value for ourselves in those things we do for compliance, you know, that's just even that much better. Because I don't want to say we're going to do it anyway. We may as well figure out a way for it to help us be more profitable or safer or whatever the situation may be.
and to think about it from a continuous improvement in terms of operational things that you do to add to the value of your product, that I would look to take those compliance actions and put them into the value add column rather than the expense column. Or look for ways to do that, if you will.
So if I'm understanding correctly, then we can look for continued improvement in this equipment and in the processes and more information coming from these testing machines. Is that correct?
I believe so. Yes. I'm not believe so, like in a way that says I'm not sure, but no, I think I don't know where else it would go. It would continue. The more information you have to make decisions, the better decisions you can make, right? We never have all the information we would like to have to make a decision. We generally
right.
don't.
Right.
But the more information you have on the characteristics of the product that you're holding in inventory, I think you can make better decisions about what to do with it, where to formulate it, what to mix with it, and a lot of other decisions and decision choices that you know, in terms of, you know, what is its net energy value, its, you know, processing value, that type of thing in terms of soybeans. All these things help us to make decisions about what to do with the crop and the ingredients that we have on hand.
Okay. Well, Gretchen, is there anything I've failed to ask or anything you'd like to mention that we've left out?
Nothing major. I just would like to add one last little bit about sampling, because it's the testing part is precipitated by the sampling has to come first, right? And sampling is a bit of, it's a technique, but it's also kind of a science. It's kind of an art, when to sample, how much to take. Your goal is always a representative sample from the batch, right, that reflects the characteristics of the batch. Easier said than done, particularly when your batches come in at 400 to 800 bushel wagons, right, or something like that, or a semi-truck that holds 1,000 bushels. Getting a batch of that that's representative from all parts of the vehicle is challenging, and it's time-consuming. I would say this, if you're going to go to the work of taking a sample and putting a sampling plan in place, whether that is a composite sample to reflect the morning and the afternoon, or a composite sample that would reflect all of the day's receipt, or even a weekly sample that you just take a random sample or a certain number of random samples during the week. If you sample it, follow through on the testing. I had a colleague once that told me, if you take a sample and then don't use the data that you have access to, you might as well put a pile of money on the ground and light it a fire. And I think it's a good analogy, because it's true, right? If you're going to go to the work of getting the sample, then run the test, follow through, archive the data so that it's usable, and then use it, right? That would be, from my perspective, probably the best thing you could do to both manage your risk as well as to continuously improve your operations.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense.
It's easier said than done, but setting up the process is, I think, an important first step on doing these types of management systems, if you will.
Yes, and being dedicated to finding the time to finish it, like, as you say, yeah.
Yes, but other than that, I think we are headed into, you know, harvest is always busy, and you know, we bring in a high level of samples in the fall as well. But just know that harvest will end eventually, and then that's when the fun really begins, is what to do with all the product, right? And how to manage, how to hold it, how long to hold it, things like that. All could be made more straightforward and less subjective with good data that come from testing and sampling.
Makes sense to me. There's always room for improvement, right? To do a better job than you're doing today.
And you're kind of the captain of that ship when you're the quality manager or the operations manager. That's your ship to steer and go for it.
Set the expectation, right?
Indeed, yes.
It's time for our famous three. Evonik Animal Nutrition is committed to ensure food security and safety while reducing the ecological footprint of animal farming. Its products and services use evidence-based solutions that seek to promote animal welfare and reduce reliance on natural resources. All this is underpinned by long-standing industry partnerships and deep customer understanding. Evonik's focus on efficiency, sustainable, healthy nutrition, and collaborations with livestock farming partners creates value for customers and consumers.
We'll wrap up then. I hope that everybody viewing has enjoyed this podcast and has learned a little something. And if you have, why share it with other people? Let them know that it's worth watching, and feel free to investigate and look for opportunities. Gretchen, if you don't mind, I've got a couple questions I'd like to ask you unrelated real quick. Just three short ones. I'm interested. So like within your professional life, do you have a single, you know, like a book or a resource that you go to for help when you need it?
I usually use, if I have a question, there's a great book written. There's been good books written since, but I use a book that was written in 2006 by a guy named Carl Reed, who was at Kansas State University, on the preservation of grain quality post-harvest. I don't know exactly what the title is off the top of my head, but it is really almost like a Bible to me. It talks about grain as it comes off, you know, post-harvest treatment. And my colleagues, Dirk Meyer and Kurt Rosentrader, have both written books similar to that, and I utilize those as well. But Reed's was the first book that I used, and it really brought me up to speed. I was raised in a farming community, but I was not raised on a farm. I married into a farm family, so I learned it on the job, and but the application of these other concepts to farming is and handling of grain post-harvest has been critical to me as I've learned things and learned to apply and put pieces together and so on. But Carl Reed's book on preservation of grain quality has been critical to me.
Kind of the same question, if you don't mind. Do you have a book or a resource that, you know, in your personal life that you find value in?
I read a lot of books. Probably the best book that I have ever read is a book, and I am terrible with titles, and I should have looked this up ahead of time, I know, but it's basically called It's All Politics. You know, get your point across when the data don't really matter. It's a political situation. It's All Politics, it's called. And I read it about once a year just to remind myself that it's not always about the facts. Sometimes it's about how the facts are framed, who the facts are framed to, and how. And the fact that it's not always the work that is the most important. It is who the work is presented to and how it's presented, and being in the right place at the right time is sometimes a critical part of getting scientific points across, certainly, but even outside of the field of science.
That's great advice, particularly in this day and age, isn't it? When things are different.
Particularly in places where things have always, quote unquote, been done the same way, right? Which is not always the case, but
it's perceived
pushing
to be
forward that. New ideas is a very political process. And I think it helps me to remember to be patient with people. And I recognize and am grateful for their patience with me as I learn their environment. And I don't want to be the person that comes in and says, I know what to do, you don't, right? That is not what I intend to do. I'd rather learn from them and have it be more of a two-way conversation, and recognizing the politics, of the situation is helpful when I do that.
Absolutely. Okay. Then one last question then. In your opinion, you know, in your industry, what separates the successful people from the people that are not so successful?
I think it is a willingness to take seriously disruptive innovations that come down the pike. Not necessarily to act on every one of them, but to evaluate them and assess them. Is this gonna help or is it not? because the innovation itself is not necessarily the best thing always, right? I think sometimes people think if we can throw technology at this thing, it'll fix it. It won't fix it. The problem will still be there. And what I often tell my undergraduate quality management students is the idea itself is just an idea until you kind of lay the rails with data, with trying to understand the process that you're improving and the information on why things are done the way they are, the contributing factors, the root cause analysis, the five why, right? Like, why are we doing it this way? Well, because we've always done it like this. So why have we always done it? You know, and go down that hole. I think if people are willing to take an honest look at what they have done and what they could do in terms of continuous improvement, those are the people that are successful. And I think I read once, and I don't remember who the quote came from. I'll use one from Ed Deming, who is the godfather of quality management in the U.S. and Japan, where he said, you know, something like improvement is not critical, but neither is survival, right? It's, at the end of the day, you have to improve and move forward with things to survive. If you're not willing to do that, survival is not guaranteed, right? And
yeah, that's an excellent point.
Easier said than done as well, but it is, and sometimes it's hard to recognize, like, am I the problem here, or am I the one holding things up? Sometimes we just need to take a good look at ourselves in the mirror and think about that. But, you know, that's how I try to think about things, I guess, from my perspective. And when I see people who are successful, I think one of the things they do is they don't follow every new idea, but they consider every new idea, potentially. Think about it, discard some maybe, but pursue things that will really benefit them in terms of their operational efficiency and effectiveness as well as their bottom line.
Yeah, well said. Okay, well, I think with that, we'll wrap up this podcast. So to all our viewers out there, thank you very much for joining. We look forward to seeing you again, and God bless you.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.